Chapter 20. Like a long dog, and jumped safe over edge, before the praying bull had got on his feet again to take after him. William used to say that he'd seen a man look a fool a good many times, but never such a fool as that bull looked, when he found his pious feelings had been played upon, and 'twas not Christmas Eve. Yes, William Dewey, that was the man's name. And I can tell you to a foot, where's he a lying in Millstock Churchyard at this very moment, just between the second yew tree and the north aisle. It's a curious story. It carries us back to medieval times, when faith was a living thing. The remark, singular for a dairy yard, was murmured by the voice behind the dun cow, but as nobody understood the reference, no notice was taken, except that the narrator seemed to think it might imply skepticism as to his tale. Well, 'tis quite true, sir, whether or no. I know the man well. Oh yes, I have no doubt of it, said the person behind the dun cow. Tess's attention was thus attracted to the dairyman's interlocutor, of whom she could see but the merest patch, owing to his burying his head so persistently in the flank of the milcher. She could not understand why he should be addressed as, or even by the dairyman himself. But no explanation was discernible. He remained under two cow long enough to have milked three, uttering a private ejaculation now and then, as if he could not get on. Take it gentle, sir, take it gentle, said the dairyman. 'Tis knack, not strength that does it. So I find, said the other, standing up at last and stretching his arms. Think I have finished her, however, though she made my fingers ache. Tess could then see him at full length. He wore the ordinary white pinner and leather leggings of a dairy farmer when milking, and his boots were clogged with the mulch of the yard. But this was all his local livery. Beneath it was something educated, reserved, subtle, sad, differing. But the details of his aspect were temporarily thrust aside by the discovery that he was one whom as he had seen before. Such vicissitudes had Tess passed through since that time, that for a moment she could not remember where as he had met him, and then it flashed upon her that he was the pedestrian who had joined in the club dance at Marlott, the passing stranger who had come she knew not whence, had danced with others, but not with her, and slightingly left her, and gone on his way with his friends. The flood of memories brought back by this revival of an incident anterior to her troubles produced a momentary dismay lest, recognizing her also, he should by some means discover her story. But it passed away when she found no sign of remembrance in him. She saw by degrees that since their first and only encounter his mobile face had grown more thoughtful, and had acquired a young man's shapely mustache and beard, the latter of the palest straw color, where it began upon his cheeks, and deepening to a warm brown farther from its root. Under his linen milking pinner he wore a dark velveteen jacket, cord breeches and gaiters, and a starched white shirt. Without the milking gear nobody could have guessed what he was. He might with equal probability have been an eccentric landowner or a gentlemanly plowman. That he was but a novice at dairy work as he had realized in a moment, from the time he had spent upon the milking of one cow. Meanwhile many of the milkmaids had said to one another of the newcomer, "How pretty she is!" with something of real generosity and admiration, though with a half-hope that the auditors would qualify the assertion which, strictly speaking, they might have done, prettiness being an inexact definition of what struck the eye in Tess. When the milking was finished for the evening they straggled indoors, where Mrs. Crick, the dairyman's wife who was too respectable to go out milking herself, and wore a hot stuff gown in warm weather, because the dairymaid's war prince was giving an eye to the leads and things. Only two or three of the maids, Tess learned, slept in the dairy house besides herself, most of the helpers going to their homes. She saw nothing at supper time of the superior milker who had commented on the story, and asked no questions about him, the remainder of the evening being occupied in arranging her place in the bedchamber. It was a large room over the milk house, some 30 feet long, the sleeping cots of the other three indoor milkmaids being in the same apartment. They were blooming young women, and, except one, rather older than herself. By bedtime, Tess was thoroughly tired, and fell asleep immediately. But one of the girls who occupied an adjoining bed was more wakeful than Tess, and would insist upon relating to the latter various particulars of the homestead into which he had just entered. The girl's whispered words mingled with the shades, and, to Tess's drowsy mind, they seemed to be generated by the darkness in which they floated. Mr. Angel Clare, he that is learning milking, and that plays the harp never says much to us. He is a passing son, and is too much taken up by his own thoughts to notice girls. He is the dairyman's pupil learning farming in all its branches. He has learned sheep farming at another place, and he's now mastering dairy work. Yes, he is quite the gentleman born. His father is the Reverend Mr. Clare at Emminster, a good many miles from here. Oh, I have heard of him, said her companion, now awake. Very earnest clergyman, is he not? Yes, that he is the earnestest man in all Wessex. They say the last of the old low church sort. They tell me for all about here be what they call high. All his sons, except our Mr. Clare, be made passons too. Tess had not at this hour the curiosity to ask why the present Mr. Clare was not made a parson like his brethren, and gradually fell asleep again, the words of her informant coming to her along with the smell of the cheeses in the adjoining cheese loft, and the measured dripping of the whey from the rings downstairs. XVIII, Angel Clare rises out of the past not altogether as a distinct figure, but as an appreciative voice, a long regard of fixed, abstracted eyes, and a mobility of mouth somewhat too small and delicately lined for a man's, though with an unexpectedly firm close of the lower lip now and then, enough to do away with any inference of indecision. Nevertheless, something nebulous, preoccupied, vague, in his bearing and regard, marked him as one who probably had no very definite aim or concern about his material future. Yet as a lad people had said of him, that he was one who might do anything if he tried. He was the youngest son of his father, a poor parson at the other end of the county, and had arrived at Talbothay's dairy as a 6 months pupil, after going the round of some other farms, his object being to acquire a practical skill in the various processes of farming, with a view either to the colonies, or the tenure of a home farm, as circumstances might decide. His entry into the ranks of the agriculturists and breeders was a step in the young man's career which had been anticipated neither by himself nor by others. Mr. Clare the elder, whose first wife had died, and left him a daughter, married a second late in life. This lady had somewhat unexpectedly brought him 3 sons, so that between Angel, the youngest, and his father the vicar there seemed to be almost a missing generation. Of these boys the aforesaid Angel, the child of his old age, was the only son who had not taken a university degree, though he was the single one of them whose early promise might have done full justice to an academical training. Some 2 or 3 years before Angel's appearance at the Marlott dance, on a day when he had left school and was pursuing his studies at home, a parcel came to the vicarage from the local booksellers, directed to the Reverend James Clare. The vicar having opened it, and found it to contain a book, read a few pages, whereupon he jumped up from his seat, and went straight to the shop with the book under his arm. "Why has this been sent to my house?" he asked peremptorily, holding up the volume. "It was ordered, sir. Not by me, or anyone belonging to me, I am happy to say." The shopkeeper looked into his order book. "Oh, it has been misdirected, sir," he said. "Tea was ordered by Mr. Angel Clare, and should have been sent to him." Mr. Clare winced, as if he had been struck. He went home pale and dejected, and called Angel into his study. "Look into this book, my boy," he said. "W, what do you know about it?" "I ordered it," said Angel simply. "What for?" "To read." "H, how can you think of reading it?" "How can I? Why, it is a system of philosophy. There is no more moral, or even religious, work published." "Yes, moral enough. I don't deny that. but religious. And for you, who intend to be a minister of the gospel. Since you have alluded to the matter, Father, said the son, with anxious thought upon his face, I should like to say, once for all, that I should prefer not to take orders. I fear I could not conscientiously do so. I love the church as one loves a parent. I shall always have the warmest affection for her. There is no institution for whose history I have a deeper admiration. But I cannot honestly be ordained her minister, as my brothers are, while she refuses to liberate her mind from an untenable redemptive theology. It had never occurred to the straightforward and simple-minded vicar that one of his own flesh and blood could come to this. He was stultified, shocked, paralyzed. And if Angel were not going to enter the church, what was the use of sending him to Cambridge? The university as a step to anything but ordination seemed, to this man of fixed ideas, a preface without a volume. He was a man not merely religious, but devout, a firm believer not as the phrase is now elusively construed by theological thimble riggers in the church, and out of it, but in the old and ardent sense of the evangelical school. One who could, indeed, opine that the eternal and divine did, 18 centuries ago in very truth. Angel's father tried argument, persuasion, entreaty. No, Father, I cannot underwrite Article 4, leave alone the rest, taking it in the literal and grammatical sense as required by the Declaration, and, therefore, I can't be a parson in the present state of affairs, said Angel. Why whole instinct in matters of religion is towards reconstruction. To quote your favorite epistle to the Hebrews, the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. Apostrophe, his father grieved so deeply, that it made Angel quite ill to see him. What is the good of your mother and me economizing, and stinting ourselves to give you a university education, if it is not to be used for the honor and glory of God, his father repeated. Why, that it may be used for the honor and glory of man, Father. Perhaps if Angel had persevered he might have gone to Cambridge like his brothers. But the vicar's view of that seat of learning as a stepping stone to orders alone was quite a family tradition, and so rooted was the idea in his mind, that perseverance began to appear to the sensitive son akin to an intent to misappropriate a trust, and wrong the pious heads of the household, who had been and were, as his father had hinted, compelled to exercise much thrift, to carry out his uniform plan of education for the three young men. I will do without Cambridge, said Angel at last. I feel that I have no right to go there in the circumstances. The effects of this decisive debate were not long in showing themselves. He spent years and years in desultory studies, undertakings, and meditations. He began to evince considerable indifference to social forms and observances. The material distinctions of rank and wealth he increasingly despised. Even the good old family, to use a favorite phrase of a late local worthy, had no aroma for him, unless there were good new resolutions in its representatives. As a balance to these austerities, when he went to live in London, to see what the world was like, and with a view, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.